Every writer knows the secret terror. You're brilliant one moment, worthless the next. This isn't imposter syndrome. It's the writer's natural state. Between these extremes lies the only question that matters. Can you hold yourself together long enough to finish something? Most people believe they have a book inside them, yet few understand that writing isn't about talent alone. It's about managing the psychological warfare that accompanies creative expression. The difference between published authors and abandoned manuscripts isn't genius. It's the capacity to contain your own ambivalence, to write through the voices insisting you're not worthy, to finish despite the fear. Your subject chooses you more than you choose it. Writers don't select themes based on market trends. They're haunted by obsessions they can't escape. Who predicted bestsellers from a Savannah murder story or essays about childhood humiliation? The most striking books emerge from what writers can't stop thinking about, whether exile, revenge, or love. As William Gass admitted, "I write because I hate." Many great books are born from anger and the struggle for self-definition. Writers are people for whom the world doesn't sit right, and books become safe spaces to explore feelings banished from polite conversation. We romanticize natural writers with effortless brilliance, but workshops reveal a different truth. Talent doesn't guarantee easier writing and sometimes complicates it. The real predictor of success isn't talent. It's perseverance, blending ability, ego, desire, and discipline. Consider the dyslexic professor who published 5 influential books, or Frank McCourt finding his voice at 66. Michael Cunningham persisted through dry spells, noting that a certain fearlessness in the face of your own ineptitude is a useful tool. Most writers began as childhood outsiders with acute self-awareness. Truman Capote was 9 when "something took over inside me, some little demon that made me a writer." For writers, being unable to write feels unbearable. Pablo Neruda said, "For me, writing is like breathing. I could not live without breathing, and I could not live without writing." Writers constantly form sentences, gather observations, reduce experiences for future use, spending solitary hours trying to connect with others. Writers who expose family secrets risk rejection. Philip Roth faced accusations of anti-Semitism after Defender of the Faith, while Portnoy's complaint horrified his community. Every writer who pulls back the curtain risks offense, whether Jhumpa Lahiri's portrayal of Bengali American life or Junot Diaz's raw depiction of Dominican immigrants. What separates bold writers from those who tiptoe around subjects? Entitlement, the feeling you have the right to say whatever you want. Dickens's childhood abandonment permeates his fiction with orphans and neglect. This combination of hurt and desire keeps writers working. Yet writers equally fear exposure, especially to family. Writing means breaking silence, but our culture discourages taking pain seriously, considering stoicism virtuous. Ironically, many damning childhood books are dedicated to parents. Pat Conroy's brutal The Great Santini, inscribed to his father, Dorothy Allison's harrowing Bastard Out of Carolina, to her mother. You must give yourself permission to tell, and more importantly, give up hoping people will like your work. Hope instead they love or hate it, find it exquisite or revolting. Literary self-promotion has deep roots. Walt Whitman's self-published Leaves of Grass at 35, then leaked Emerson's praise letter to the New York Tribune without permission. Emily Dickinson asked delicately, "Are you too deeply occupied to say if my verse is alive?" She died leaving over 2,000 unpublished poems. Every writer secretly wonders, "Why isn't that me?" when peers succeed. We're suspicious of writers who court fame, as if serious work and self-promotion were incompatible. Joyce Maynard endured decades of derision for writing about herself and exposing her relationship with Salinger. Yet, what writer doesn't excavate their life for material? Wanting recognition isn't a crime. Norman Mailer boldly declared his work would have the deepest influence of any American novelist. Yet, even celebrated writers suffer crippling self-doubt. Susan Sontag described writing as climbing Mount Everest, while Judith Guest felt like a trickster after her bestseller. Whether you hide like Dickinson or live flamboyantly like Mailer, ultimately, you live or die by your line. Writers are inherently neurotic, developing ritualized behaviors about when, where, and how they can produce. When successful, these quirks become your process. When unsuccessful, they're excuses. As Joyce Carol Oates notes, one must be pitiless about this matter of mood. The writing will create the mood. Great writing requires only paper and pencil, not a new laptop or ergonomic chair. When writers indulge neurotic notions about necessary conditions, they're stalling. The feared stimulus is writing itself. Writers' phobias create protective walls, allowing entry into the supremely narcissistic world of the page, where they become more alive inside their work than in reality. Writers have a conflicted relationship with their craft. Many claim writing makes them miserable, yet admit they're never happier than when immersed. William Styron confessed, "Writing is hell," while Hemingway described it erotically. "I suffer like a bastard when I don't write, but I never feel as good as while writing." Writers struggle financially, with no guarantees, and during publication, their deepest insecurities surface as they simultaneously crave and fear exposure. Rejection often intensifies after publication. View it as a ladder: form letters, personalized notes, then acceptance. John Grisham's first novel faced dozens of rejections before a small press printed 5,000 copies. He immediately began his next novel, The Firm, which launched his career. Find peers slightly ahead of you during rejection-heavy years. Literary history shows writers have always relied on each other: Wordsworth and Coleridge, Hemingway and Fitzgerald. Before attempting book publication, make your work rejection-proof through smaller venues. Julie Powell's cooking blog became Julie and Julia, earning traditional publishing deals. Editors live for discovering original voices, like reading Lolita in Tehran, which stayed on bestseller lists for over 100 weeks. If rejection letters make you quit writing, you've given them too much power. Thank editors for their time and ask if they'd consider future work. Never mistake polite rejection for encouragement. Only follow editorial advice if it genuinely resonates with your vision. Ultimately, only you can stop yourself from writing. In an age promising instant success, writing remains stubbornly slow and uncertain. The publishing industry faces upheaval: print contracting, bookstores closing, traditional models crumbling. Yet what endures is the writer's voice and the reader's connection to it. Your job isn't predicting what will sell. It's writing sentences that are yours alone and believing fiercely in your vision. Pre-publication offers complete freedom. Most books enter the world quietly, yet the ones that matter find their readers, sometimes immediately, sometimes across decades. The writing life demands everything: time, sanity, relationships, sense of self. It offers no guarantees. Yet for those who cannot stop, who form sentences while walking, who reduce experiences into words, there is no choice. To write is to breathe. The question isn't whether you'll face rejection or obscurity. It's whether you can write through it anyway, whether you can finish what you start, whether you can say what only you can say.